I am really excited about talking about the application part of this. We're in the second chapter. I think everybody was here on Sunday. Maybe it would be good for us to go ahead and read it, the section we're talking about. Let's start at verse 17 and read through the end. What this is this is when, after Ruth is done working for the day, she gathers up what she has and she brings it back to Naomi, and there's this great interaction between those two that we talked about on Sunday. Can I get somebody to read, please, that section 17 to the end of the chapter? Thank you, Dean.
So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you work? Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with this young woman, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young woman of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law.
Great. Thank you. As a review, we spent most of the time on Sunday about this word hesed, is in verse 20, where it says, "Whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." This word hesed. Somebody want to remind us what that means? Thanks, Jeff.
It's loving kindness is the Hebrew word to use. A lot of times it's used for God and the loving kindness that he shows his people.
Yeah, and is it just a feeling that we have? What kind of love is this?
Action.
It's an action love, right? So what New Testament word do we use a lot for the same kind of a thing? I think Jeff brought it up on Sunday. Agape, yeah, agape love. It's almost, when I was talking to David about it, he's almost like when we're talking about the Old Testament, it's good, we should be using this word hesed more to explain this kind of love, and it should be something that we should remember, because it is this love of action, and that's what we have here. We have this love of action, this kindness that Boaz bestowed upon Ruth by letting her glean in the field and giving her the extra, and Naomi saw that. And at the end of that verse, I remember we started off saying there's a lot packed in that verse 20. What does this mean, has not forsaken the living or the dead? Be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Any thoughts on what that could be talking about? Yeah, Roy?
I just interpreted that to mean that they were both widows, and the living and the dead factors into that, because normally their husband would be taking care of them, but he's taking care of them in their in their debilitating situation without husbands.
Yeah, who's dead?
Their husbands
are dead. Yeah, so it's interesting that saying that the Lord has not forsaken the living or the dead. Basically taking care of that responsibility of their dead husbands, right? So then who would the living be?
The widows.
Yeah, so that's a great way to think about that. Were you going to add to that anything, Lisa?
No.
Yeah, okay. When it says, the Lord, blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead, who is he talking about there? Yahweh? No, the he. May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness have forsaken for... Huh? Sorry, I didn't ask the right question. Huh? It's Boaz, right? Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't know if this is what you're getting at, but if you're asking who the who is talking about. Mm-hmm. Is the who talking about the Lord, or is the who talking about the he?
Right, and that's a question.
And I think, I mean, that's my question in my head, because when I read it, it sounds like it's talking about the he, meaning Boaz. Mm-hmm. So Boaz has not forsaken the Lord's kindness to the living and the dead.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. And the only reason I say the Lord's kindness is because the his is capitalized in my Bible, but I know that in the Hebrew, they don't do that, right?
Yeah, so any other thoughts? So, is the kindness Boaz's kindness, or is it the Lord's kindness? That's a better way to ask that question. Yeah.
At least the one person, the one writer that I consulted, said that in the Hebrew it's ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it clear, but said that based on the Hebrew, specifically on the Hebrew, it could be either of the two, or it could even be intentionally vague and refer to both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, I actually like that interpretation too. Were you going to add something to it?
I was going
to
say, Rich Maurer's not in this class, but I'm going to use his favorite word, polyvalent, in the sense that we may be actually referring to both. It may be the Lord's kindness as conduited through Boaz.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a reflection of the Lord's kindness coming through him,
yeah,
as opposed to either's specifically.
Correct. Yeah, and if you think about it, if Boaz is God-fearing, is doing what he's supposed to be doing, following what the Lord wants him to do by showing this kindness, isn't he reflecting the Lord? So it is ambiguous. You see,
ambiguous.
Man. Ambiguous on who that could mean, and it probably means both. Yeah, but I like the way you guys define that. So that was one of the questions, right? What did she mean with the phrase, has not forsaken the living and the dead? We talked about that. It's also interesting when we go to the next verse. I'm still on 20. The last part of that verse. Naomi also said to her, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. Why is she saying that at this point?
Because she's a schemer. She wants to marry off.
That's one way to look at it. Is Ruth at this point thinking about it from that way?
Naomi.
Any other thoughts on that?
No. I say no.
What do you think's going on?
I don't know. If it's one of our redeemers,
mm-hmm,
maybe you should get to know him.
With the law of Moses, I mean, yes, she would be thinking of the elaborate marriage,
mm-hmm,
system that was built into the actually part of the law of Moses. They had expanded on it by this point, but just strictly speaking, confined within the law of Moses, the relative, if her husband died, then his closest relative would be responsible,
mm-hmm,
for taking care of the widow. And if the closest relative refuses to do that within the law, they were supposed to take his shoe off and then spit in his face publicly to show the disgrace that you're not taking care of your brother's wife. So that was all built into the law of Moses. So some of that must, even if part of that is in her mind, that's the only rational way to come up to explain that statement that she makes.
It's interesting that she's already jumped past the one who's closer, right? Were you going to say something, Roy?
Why would Naomi be the one that would redeem or would redeem instead of Ruth?
Because typically that is tied with childbearing and carrying on the name. And it's kind of confusing because we end up talking about two different things here, and we're going to get into that. There's two different things in this redemption that goes on. And one of them is this levirate marriage, which is usually with a close relative, and it's usually to have so that there'd be childbearing so the name would continue on. So in that case, it wouldn't count for Naomi, which we can deduce that she was beyond childbearing years, which we talked about even in chapter 1 when she was saying to her.
Well, she nursed, right?
She did nurse.
So I don't think she necessarily was beyond childbearing years, but I think Ruth was a more viable candidate.
Yeah,
to
I guess
be,
that's true.
To look, you mm-hmm. know, like a, you know, potential wife. And probably she felt like, I am past that time. I don't even want to go back there. But you, my daughter, you're young. Go for it.
Yeah, and that, and maybe I need to go back and read chapter one, but in light of chapter one, maybe when she says, you know, don't wait around for me to have a kid, meaning it would take too long by the time I even had a kid. So then...
In chapter one, I think she's saying kind of sarcastically in a way, yeah. Like, what, are you going to wait for that? Of course not.
Yeah.
Right.
Not that she's beyond that age, it's just that by the time this kid was old enough, it wouldn't be work anyways. Yeah. So then that does add the good question, would Naomi then be subject to that same thing? And she even uses the term one of our redeemers, right, in verse 20. Yeah, we're going
to... Well, in chapter 1, and verse 12, she does start out by saying, I am too old to have a husband. Now, we can then discuss what it means to be too old to have a husband. Does that mean too old to bear children? Then she kind of goes on and says, even if I had hope. So she seems to say fairly strongly that she is not a candidate for marriage, whether that's biological or her... She's pretty firm.
Yeah, and it's one, another one of these things where we may not have the best answer or the exact answer for why Naomi, to Roy's original question, why would Naomi not qualify? Maybe she's just coming so I can wrap this up and move on. Maybe she, the best, unless you guys want to debate it more or talk about it more, but maybe she's just saying that's maybe our best chance, right? She's already been at the field. He's already shown her kindness. Could be taken that she's saying, look, this is our best chance, is one way to take it that. I did read quite a bit of commentaries that actually said, even in this term, one of our redeemers, this close relative, one of our redeemers, was also, when you read the language, could mean not that she wasn't actually thinking about the marriage yet, that it was more just about, this is a close relative, he could help us in our situation that we have, right? Not the technical marriage thing, but just trying to help him out.
The land.
Go ahead.
Well, also, I don't know. When I said she nursed, like, it says she's her nurse. I don't know if that means she nursed.
Nurses or not.
I don't know. It could be.
It's okay.
It may not mean that.
We can't come to a conclusion that's not in there, but we don't know for sure, yeah. And that's the interesting part about this book is there's some ambiguity in it that we want to make sure we don't come to any conclusions on. But it does have us have some great conversations about it, including this one. It's not really clear if she's really scheming, in my mind, the more I've read it and looked at these commentaries, or if she's just saying, hey, this is one of our relatives who's going to help us out, redeem us in our situation that we're in. Yeah, were you going to say something, Lisa?
Yeah, you're probably getting to the gall, that word, L-I-G-O-L.
Goel or gall, yeah.
Yeah, and it's restoring the rights of, a wrong, so maybe it was just financially... Also, we wouldn't have to be married.
Mm-hmm.
Which word are we talking about?
Sorry. The Goel, the Gaul. How do you pronounce that? G-O with the line across it? And anybody got their Hebrew?
I think it's Goel.
Goel. So it's that Goel law. So let's explain that. What is the Goel law? And let's talk about the Levirate law. Let's Goel first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Goel, I just wrote... The Hebrew terms come from the word L-I-G-O-L, legal.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. But
that's why you pronounce it like
I
that?
Yeah.
And I ran across one that was just like the letter G and the letter L when I was reading it too. So I guess there's a couple different ways to write it or pronounce it. But anyways, so what is this Goel law? We already here talked about a little bit, to right a wrong. Where does that come from? Deuteronomy. Should we turn over there? 19. Six through 13. I'll go ahead and read it. I'm actually going to... This is talking about the cities of refuge is what this is in reference to. So starting at verse 6. Lest the avenger of blood in hot anger pursue the manslayer and overtake him because the way is long and strike him fatally. Though the man did not deserve to die since he had not hated his neighbor in the past. Therefore I command you, you shall set apart three cities and if the Lord your God enlarges your territory as he has sworn to your fathers and gives you all the land that he has promised to give your father, provided... You are careful to keep all his commandment, which I command you today, by loving the Lord your God and by walking ever in his ways. Then you shall add three other cities to these three, lest innocent blood be shed in your land that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance, and so that the guilt of the blood shed be upon you. But if anyone hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him and attacks him and strikes him fatally so that he dies and he flees into one of these cities, then the elders of this city shall send and take him from there and hand him over to the avenger of blood so that he may die. Your eyes shall not pity him, but you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from Israel so that it may be well with you. So how does that tie into this idea of this Goel? Should we turn to Leviticus as well?
25.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have it up right now.
Go ahead.
Beginning at verse 47. Now, if the means of a stranger or of a sojourner with you become sufficient... Well, I guess we'll keep reading that. All right, we'll go with that. With you become sufficient, and a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is sojourning with you, or to the descendants of a stranger's family, then he shall have redemption right after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or one of his blood relatives from his family may redeem him, or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. So being close to relative is to redeem something that's had to sell themselves into slavery.
Yeah. Yeah, and the same thing goes, what was getting to, I think why David put that at the Deuteronomy reference, is the same thing goes when you're when there's innocent blood that's been shed, and you have the right to then exercise that right, to I guess it's not the term redeem, but if you're going to make right what has happened, is that same Goel law. So it's interesting that there's two here. So Naomi lost the right to her property, right, by leaving, and then her husband dying. So there's that, and then there's also this marriage, and that's the levirate law of marriage, which we did talk about generally. So what is the levirate law of marriage? I think Terry basically said it, right? Which is, it started off to be your brother. That's the original intention. And what's interesting is it goes all the way back into Genesis, and we don't have time to get in there, but it even goes back to Genesis with Judah, I think, with this same law. But it has, by this time, changed to where it's gone beyond just the brother. And the idea there is to make sure the name carries on. We talked about before, is you're in a bad position if you're a widow, and especially a poor widow, because you don't have rights either way. So back to Ruth, when Naomi says this, is she thinking all that through? I guess is the main question. Is she thinking about all that when she hears from Ruth that Boaz was the one who was kind to her? Any other thoughts on that? Do you guys see it could go either way, or do you guys feel pretty strongly one or the other?
I have a thought that's kind of, it's not very good because I'm just now thinking of it.
That's okay.
But it's interesting, that concept of redemption. That seems like a really strong word to me, and like a better word would just be perpetuate, right? So keep the lineage going, perpetuate it. But we don't have that word. We have the word redeem, which seems really pretty strong for that situation. I think part of that is just the fact that we're in a society where we don't really gauge our success or whatever on the next generation down. We're kind of more self-sufficient minded, and that's probably maybe not good, maybe it is good in some ways or whatever. But we don't think about like having a son to keep the name going and how important that is and that feeling of redemption. But then, you know, tie this back into the story and what that means to Ruth and Naomi, and then thinking about how the redemption or the perpetuation of that family lineage leads to our Savior that actually redeems us is pretty crazy.
I know.
And so then, it's a very appropriate word to use in that situation, because we depend on that too. Mm-hmm. It's our redemption as well. I don't know, just a thought.
Were you going to say something, Lisa?
Yeah, that Christ redeemed us from our evil, and Boaz will redeem their family member, and others redeem slaves, and it's making right wrong.
Yeah, how does that go well go towards us when you think of it from New Testament terms?
Very personal. Makes this story very personal.
Yeah.
And it makes me hinge on every last word, like, it's got to happen, it's got to happen. Well, we know that it does, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have that perspective.
Yeah, and who have we sold ourselves to? Huh? The devil? Right? That's interesting if you think about it. We have sold ourselves to, have we lost our right? When we sin and sold ourselves to doing bad things, right? It's the same. How comparable is that to this same Old Testament law? It's interesting how much the old law comes alive when you think of it in those terms. I think that's how Brady put it. I see a hand over here, Jeff. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing on the redemption, just, you know, it kind of brings it out in Leviticus 25, but the reason that they got into this whole idea of redemption to begin with is the land belonged
mm-hmm.
to God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then God decided he was going to give certain parts of land to certain tribes. And God foresaw that, okay, some landowner is going to get himself into a financial bind. He's got an asset that he can sell, which is the land that I have given to his family.
Mm-hmm.
And so God wanted in the law a provision for somebody in that family to redeem that land back. He didn't want that land to, in perpetuity, go to someone from a different tribe mm-hmm. or someone from an entirely different nationality just because they had the money to afford that. And so, in the law, he had a provision for somebody in the family that he originally gave the land to redeem that land and buy it back. And that's kind of where the whole concept
where it all started from. Yeah, yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah, Luke?
Yeah, and so strong, dovetailing off of what Jeff said, so strong was that finding in there that if you continue on, it says that if what is sold in this manner is like just a dwelling within a city, that the year of Jubilee does not apply to the dwelling within a city. Little box you're going to just put your bed in, that doesn't apply. But if it is the land, if it is an unwalled city or it is the open land, the year of Jubilee will apply to this. So even if no one can ever redeem it back in the family, it's going to go back to that family, that tribe, that household in the year of Jubilee.
That's pretty cool. I mean, it's pretty cool that he set it up that way. What's this famous story that we tell of neighbors where this came into play? Naboth's vineyard? Remember? What's that? Yeah. Yeah. Where they wanted the vineyard, but he was like, it's not mine. It's not mine to give, right? Is what he said. And it ties back to this. It's the same reason why Israel didn't really need a king from day one, because their king was God, as we all know. And the land was given to them. They were dwelling in God's land. God was their king, right? So it's interesting that we have these laws set up. Okay, so back to then how it relates to us today. We talked about how we're dead, basically. So by having Christ redeem us out of this dead state, he has restored us back into what was promised to us, right? Isn't that that's such a cool parallel? What other parallels do we have? Or what other things we can take out of this section that tie to the gospel? Hints of the gospel to glean from these verses, as the question says.
Same word, Gual. Isaiah 60.
Mm-hmm.
When he's talking about Gentiles rising to bless Zion, he says, you shall drink the milk of the Gentiles and milk the breast of kings. You shall know that I, the Lord, am your Savior and your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. Instead of bronze, I'll bring gold. Instead of iron, I bring silver. Instead of wood, I bring bronze. And instead of stones, I bring iron. Like upgrading every single thing along the way and redeeming the Gentiles who bless Zion, which would kind of be us.
Yeah, yeah. Bring us to the glory that we don't deserve but are been blessed with, right, or given. Yeah. Any other hints of the gospel?
Well, this idea about she should stay close to the young women. If you go to another field, there's a greater chance you're going to be assaulted or whatever. The protection that's offered
mm-hmm.
in the arrangement we have
mm-hmm.
versus if we choose to leave that, the danger that awaits.
Yeah, there's a beautiful term in here back in the last section that we talked about verse 12. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. There's a couple times in Ruth that that term has come, and whose wings you have come to take refuge, right? I think that ties with that thought, Brian, that Boaz is helping and protecting them, and this whole idea of this wing. And we have similar language in the New Testament, right, about Christ protecting us.
Well, and Boaz is her redeemer, mm-hmm. and she's to stay close to her redeemer, mm-hmm. and we are to stay close to our redeemer. Mm-hmm.
Don't go in another field.
Don't go in another field.
Yeah.
Don't go where the devil wants to lead you.
Something bad could happen to you in another field. Yeah.
The redeemer.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Good point. Any others? Any other hints in this section? We've got a few minutes. What time is this class over at?
So 15 minutes.
We got a lot of time. 15 minutes.
It's maybe not a hint, but I mean, mm-hmm. I find it a little humorous, that last line. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Well, after that declaration she made in chapter 1, I hope so. Where else is she going to be?
Yeah, but you bring up a good point. Why repeat that? And she lived with her mother-in-law, this term mother-in-law. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. Why do you think the author continues to repeat that in their language? I don't know if we talked about it on the Sunday. It did strike me. Why not just say Ruth?
Ruth the Moabite.
Yeah, or they say Ruth the Moabite. I think the point is, it's that relationship of them together, their family unit, right? That she lived there with her mother-in-law, kind of reinforcing that relationship of the two of them together. Same thing, what I think why they keep repeating Ruth the Moabite, clearly stating where she's from, what state she's in, without a redeemer, without this family, without the blessings that are being given to her in Bethlehem, in the Promised Land. Without it, she's just a Moabite, if you think about it, right? Without this. Anything else?
Well, right after it says daughter-in-law, then of course she calls her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning at 3, she calls her daughter. Mm-hmm. Again. So to your point, maybe it's just talking about how their bond continues to deepen.
Yeah, and we talked about that on Sunday, that I get out of this that there is definitely concern from Naomi. She repeats a couple different times about don't stray, stay close. You can tell Naomi really cares about Ruth, right? It's not just a annoying person, roommate, living with her. They definitely love each other, which we can see throughout the book. Let's see. We talked about that. I didn't have any others on my notes for hints of the gospel.
The wings that you were, mm-hmm. in verse 12, that mm-hmm. you were talking about just a moment ago. I just wanted to add one thing, if I may. It's this aspect of under whose wings you've come to take refuge, and that, you know, they had come to the God of Israel to take refuge. So you can picture, you know, these wings coming around to protect the little chicks. It's the wings of the hen. That wings of covering is that protection. And to look upon God as our protection, just with the analogy of the gospel. So these wings of refuge, if we look to God as our wings of refuge, that's something based on what's revealed in the Old Testament that is very, very important to God, that people are seeking Him for everything, for all protection. We had a good reference just a moment ago from the book of Isaiah, and that book is just replete with passages about that, because they would go to idols, they would go to other foreign nations. Mm-hmm. Isaiah chapter 30, that chapter starts out, "You stubborn nations, woe unto you that cover with a covering, but not of my spirit. Woe unto you that seek refuge, but not of me." Makes God very angry when they, and I would apply that to my own spiritual walk with God, if I'm got to be very careful, because we need to be self-reliant, but am I being overly self-reliant? Did I forget to ask about God? Am I under your wings as I do this and ask this and seek this? Am I still under your wings as I go about this? That's by this.
Yeah, and if you think about it, even when does a chick go under the mother's wings? When something, it's cold, it's rainy, it's seeking shelter, right? I don't think we often realize what situation we're in, right? We go seek the wing and the protection when something bad is happening to us. And that it is a tough balance because we want to be independent, but we're supposed to be dependent. So it tends to be we're not dependent unless something's happening to us. And it's interesting if you think about it truly how dependent we really are on them. We should almost be under that care all the time and acting like that, right? I think is your point. That's the way we should be acting, that we're under those wings of protection at all times. But you hear people even in the world when they talk about their Christianity, it's a lot of very selfish terminology, right? It's a lot about my faith and my this and I understand this and this is what I'm going to do. There's not a whole lot of usurping what my authority or what I want to do to what God wants us to do, what the Lord wants us to do, right? If we're really under the protection, if we're really feeling as vulnerable as we're supposed to be, I think it would change the way we talk. I think it would change the way we think about it, right? Yeah, that's a great point. I really liked it. I had a slide. Sorry, I didn't get to be able to get the slideshow, but I had a great slide of wings, the wings covering over the children. I love in the New Testament a lot to talk about small children, and then in how we're supposed to be like that, right? This and the innocent and needing help. We almost feel sorry for Ruth and Naomi in the story, and then we realize, wait a second, we are Ruth and Naomi in the New Testament. That's one of the other things I take out of this from the gospel. Is we are just like them. Yeah.
I don't know if you got into this, you know, the other week, but when Boaz observes that Ruth has put her faith in God and put her trust in Him and all the good she's done to her mother-in-law, he finds that very admirable, and that's what I think prompts him to bend over backwards to do everything that he can to help her. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that he wouldn't have been kind to just anyone, but I think he really, you know, goes the extra mile for Ruth because of this trust that she has in God and the goodness that she's doing to other people. And I think that's an example for us that people who are doing good, people who've got a lot of faith in God, we ought to do whatever we can do to support those people. That should be something that we see that and we should be attracted to that and we should want to support that and do everything we can to further that and help that go forward. Mm-hmm. And I don't think when Boaz did this, he was doing it because he thought, you know, I may get a wife out of this down the road. I think he was wanting to promote what Ruth was doing for her mother-in-law and what he saw her doing in terms of her faith in God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we did talk about a little bit, but not put the point on that. We were contrasting with, is it just because she's a good-looking foreign woman that he's doing this for, or is there a deeper meaning? And I think that's the way we came away with the same thought that you're having there, right? Yeah.
So Tyler read over in Leviticus the order, mm-hmm. the redemption order, mm-hmm. in whatever that was, 25:48, where it talks about brother, then uncle, then cousin, then a close relative from mm-hmm. the clan. And so it's interesting that Naomi would describe him as a close relative of ours. I feel like if it was a brother or an uncle, they would know him and he would know them. It feels like it's a little more on the other end of the spectrum, like maybe a cousin or a close clan relative, and whoever this closer person is, we find out later. But
we don't really know. Do we ever find out who the relationship is, even at the closer?
I don't think
we're it's kind of ambiguous there as well, huh?
I would think if it was a brother and uncle, though, that the two would know each other.
Yeah.
I think Boaz defined that as one closer than I.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's all we know.
That's all we know. That's all we can really know from it, yeah.
But it feels like those are more like cousins or mm-hmm. clan people, not that tight.
And I apologize when I read that other note, Deuteronomy one earlier, because that's what's in his notes. What I wanted to read was the actual Deuteronomy 25:5. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside of the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that it is his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate and to the elders. And I think this was getting at somebody earlier, right? This is what happens if you do not do your duty. So you go up to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate, Brady, there's your word, right? Perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. And if he persists saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, pull off his sandal, off his foot. Could you imagine seeing that happen? What is happening to Jeff? He's not doing his duties. Why is that lady taking his sandal off? Anyways, and pull off his sandal, off his foot, and spit in his face, and she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house, and the name of his house shall be called Israel, the house of him who has his sandal pulled off. That's interesting, huh? Yeah, Roy.
The only Bible example we have of that is in Genesis with Judah.
Yeah.
And God killed his first two sons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they weren't doing it right.
Yeah. They weren't following that law correctly.
Yeah, so God killed them both. Yeah. You know, and then the third one was still growing up, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that, I think Jeff brought up where it was based on a lot is the land, right? But we also know how important it is to perpetuate the family. And that was the last thing I was also, and I know I'm stretching it, but I do think it is relevant. When we're talking about the gospel and perpetuating the Lord's name, I think it's really important. It's up to us to do that, right? It's our responsibility to get out there. The gospel is dependent on us to do that duty, to pass that on. We can't push it off onto somebody else. It is our responsibility, right, to do that. So that was one other little point that I had out of this.
Well, when you see how the Bible talks about genealogy and lineage, and even in this book, we're given a genealogy at the end. It clearly, that was a huge deal.
To have the name through, all the way through, yeah. Okay, great. So, start.
Dana had something to say.
Oh, yes, Dana.
She hates when I do that.
That's okay.
I have my head raised. I do. I mean, in the New Testament, it talks about in the genealogy that Boaz was the son of Rahab. And so, do you think that may have affected how he thought about this foreign woman? Because his mother was also a redeemed foreign woman. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just interesting to think about what his thoughts might have been.
I want to start calling her that from now on, a redeemed foreign woman. I don't like the other description of it. That's a much better description. This redeemed foreign woman. Okay, great. I think that's it. I think we've gleaned as much out of that. So we'll get into chapter 3 on Sunday. Thank you. I was a little all over the place today, so I appreciate your patience with me and being late. All right? But thank you.